D.A. Sky Thorleifsson presents Adaptational, the hardcover edition. Revisiting the best episodes of our first season, plus newly recorded content that was not featured during the original run. Join us at the end of the episode for our special new segment, The Appendices, for those seeking further insight into the source material, its history in cinema, and my personal connection to it. Now, enjoy the show. Today's episode was originally released on December 9th, 2017. I am forced into speech because men of science have refused to follow my advice without knowing why. It is altogether against my will that I tell my reason for opposing this contemplated invasion of the Antarctic, with its vast fossil hunt and its wholesome boring and melting of the ancient ice caps. And I am all the more reluctant because my warning may be in vain. H.P. Lovecraft, At the Mountains of Madness. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this second episode of Adaptational. My name is Sky Thorleifsson, and I'm here to continue this discussion about the adaptation process, what's great about the stories that you love, and what might possibly happen to them should they become movies. So how's everybody doing at this time? I know that this is a very exhausting period of time that you're coming off of, just finishing your studies and so forth. But I'm really glad that if you heard my last episode and you appreciated it enough, you were nice enough to tune in at this time just to hear what other crazy ideas were floating through my brain. Seriously, though, I really did love working on the last episode of Catcher in the Rye, and it was just so exciting to be able to explore that novel, which I loved so much. And hopefully, it was interesting enough that some of you were able to take the time to consider reading it yourselves. There isn't going to be much feedback in the early episodes, but please, if you have any feedback at all, if you have any thoughts or any interest in what I've been discussing over the last couple of episodes, please, at any time, feel free to email me. The podcast email is going to be adaptationalpod, that's adaptational with an A-L, P-O-D as in podcast, at gmail.com. From what I have heard, there's been a lot of positive feedback from a lot of different people who enjoyed the show and had very high compliments about it, so I hope that that can continue as I move forward with new subjects, subjects that are a little bit more obscure in this case, but still have a lot of a cult following. And that's going to start with this second episode. After Catcher in the Rye, now we move from a teenage drama to Nightmare Fuel. Nightmare Fuel as the 1930s could envision it. With this second episode, we are about to dive into a frightening subject. A world of such immensity and such insanity that few men have dared enter it. With H.P. Lovecraft's At the Mountains of Madness. And just to give you a heads up, once again, I'm going to be diving into spoiler territory. At the Mountains of Madness is narrated by an anonymous individual. He remains anonymous in the story, although in all discussions of the work that came afterwards, he was given a name, William Dyer. This is a bit of a trend in Lovecraft's stories. He loves having anonymous protagonists, who he only names at a later date. William Dyer is the head of an expedition to Antarctica in search of ancient fossils, ancient life forms that are beyond people's understanding of even the dinosaurs. He journeys with several other scientists, including 20 different students of his from the Miskatonic University in New England. Once they are there and they have started excavating, one expedition, led by Lake, one of Dyer's colleagues, heads out to an even further location, where they actually discover what appears to be well-preserved bodies of ancient life forms. Life forms that seem almost too advanced to have been far too ancient. With this discovery, Dyer and the rest of the expedition make their way to this newly found fossilized discovery, only to find a shocking revelation that the entirety of Lake's band of scientists is dead, brutally murdered by some unknown entity, and all of the fossils and all of the specimens that they had been studying up to this time have disappeared, except for a few fragmented creatures. With a few members of the expedition missing, and with few other options available to them, Dyer and another student of his named Danforth decide to conduct a further investigation into other places beyond the vast mountains in the distance. What they discover there is even more shocking than even the discovery of the specimens. They find that the mountains in the far distance are not merely mountains, but ancient walls, safeguarding a vast, unknown city, undiscovered by any other previous expedition. What they discover there becomes the source of their unequivocal madness and insanity. And it becomes the main reason why, at the beginning of the story, Dyer insists that any further exploration of the Antarctic be withdrawn indefinitely. So I'll give a little bit of my history with Lovecraft as a reader, personally. I have read the minimum number of Lovecraft's work to be considered interested in his work. I do own a large collection of his work, the commemorative edition of the Necronomicon, the best weird tales of H.P. Lovecraft. And the Necronomicon, as you will discover, is a little bit of an inside joke in its own way to Lovecraft's work. Most of the sources that I've read personally are among his shorter works of fiction, including Dagon, The Nameless City, The Color Out of Space, and of course, The Call of Cthulhu and At the Mountains of Madness. Those last two are probably the ones that most readers are familiar with Lovecraft for, and there's a very good reason why. Lovecraft's whole repertoire, published originally in pulp fiction magazines as far back as the 1920s, is almost solely dedicated to an exploration of the unknown and the unknowable. The fear that comes from reading Lovecraft's stories tend to be ones that are very unlike anything that the audience has read prior. It's reliant on the essence of things that are beyond human comprehension, ancient alien life forms that have existed long before any human walked the face of the earth. The most famous of these ancient life forms is obviously Cthulhu. Cthulhu is one of the creatures that Lovecraft created as one of the old ones, ancient creatures that govern humanity. Ultimately, they will be the end of human civilization. They were the beginning of it, and they can end it. And At the Mountains of Madness is exactly that kind of story. The story that explores a scientific expedition that discovers something that is far beyond their knowledge and understanding of how prehistory happened. The creatures that Dyer and his expedition discovers during their time in the Antarctic are very much akin to a lot of different entities that Lovecraft creates, and they have very specific descriptions attached to them. Squid-like bodies with tendrils they use to speak and communicate in their own language, but also a star-shaped motif on their head, and wings. Exactly how those wings operate, we're not exactly supposed to know. And to some extent, the scientists don't want to know how they operate. Because the possibility of knowing how these creatures live and behaved is one of the sources of their fear. Their unwavering shock and despair at discovering the creature's power and their awareness and their history. The creatures in this story are referred to in different ways as elder things and as old ones. And as Dyer and Danforth explore the world that they used to inhabit, as they explore the city that they lived in, they find evidence of how they became the true creators of life on Earth. The old ones arrived millions and billions of years before life began, when the Earth was a massive unformed rock. From this, they were able to fashion the Earth into their own likeness, and they wanted to live there for a very long time. But things change on the Earth. Massive changes in climate and massive ecological shifts have driven them away from their homes on land. Some of them were sent to the sea, and others simply died at the hands of creatures that they created entitled Shoggoths, essentially their guard dogs, which eventually grew intelligence. The ancient city and what remains of these creatures, the specimens that are found, are all that's left of the civilization that once was and once ruled the Earth. And this seems really, really preposterous when one thinks about it on those terms. But what's so impressive about Lovecraft's writing is that he is able to provide it with a legitimacy that makes one sense the overwhelming power of these creatures in this world. Lovecraft presents this story in the form of a scientific statement made by Dyer years and years after the expedition has ended. And to give legitimacy to what Dyer says about these creatures, Lovecraft uses a lot of very strong scientific paleontological terms in order to describe the timeline of the Earth. I love this aspect of the story because it is so specific to something that I loved growing up with. The idea of exploring a world that once was, long before, based on fossil evidence. And while he doesn't always have all of the exact measurements of time right, they give, especially for the time that it was released, a real strong sense of legitimacy and a tangible nature to what feels like a very realistic timeline for when the creatures of the old ones first arrived, how they created life on Earth, and then how they slowly disappeared over the course of millions of years. But what gives it an especially terrifying essence, in addition to that, there is a lot of description of how the old ones behaved, based on murals and etchings and carvings made into the walls of the city. Danforth and Dyer are able to decipher certain types of behavior and the way that creatures like this lived and thought and behaved, including around other creatures. There's even a reference at one point to how the old ones, having created a specific type of creature, looked to them for amusement. They were a source of entertainment, in the same way that humans view cockfighting, or bullfights, or gladiatorial games in ancient Rome. They were the source of entertainment. And it's one of the most frightening sequences to think about that being part of their civilization. Imagine the terror that comes from having to live with the possibility that that could happen to humanity. That humanity's own hubris could be turned on themselves if the old ones were to rise again from the ancient near death that they lived. And even going beyond that, there are still things that even the old ones seem to fear. One of the big mysteries of the entire story is what lies even beyond the mountains of madness, what lies beyond the city, in a vast haze that is hidden behind certain mountains that even the ancient ones did not dare to go past. Some vast entity, some power, some force that is unknown to them. If the ancient ones cannot comprehend that evil, that fear, and that darkness, who's to say that human beings have any way of comprehending it on their own? It is entirely possible that by the end of the story, this is what drives Danforth, the young and inexperienced scientist, to go utterly mad as he looks back on the ancient city one last time. He seems to have witnessed something that is beyond human comprehension, and his mind will never be the same again. These are the very basics of the story, but it's also very indicative of what kind of influence that H.P. Lovecraft had on the entirety of the horror genre. This is a man who influenced people like Neil Gaiman and Stephen King and Arthur C. Clarke. writers of the highest echelon in science fiction, fantasy, and horror. And it all started in the form of pulp fiction, published in magazines like Weird Tales or Astounding Stories. You see Lovecraftian imagery in many different sources. I'll be able to talk about those a little later on in the podcast. But the idea of an all-controlling, all-powerful entity that is far beyond the scale of any creature any human has ever seen. This is what gave Lovecraft his edge in the genre that he created. The scale and the enormity, the terror that comes from the unknowable. It's a style that very few writers have been able to match. And even if it is a little bit dated occasionally, and sometimes, if you read his other works, his slightly problematic view of humanity at times, other races and so forth, despite all that, there is still a draw that comes from reading Lovecraft's work. The theme that he loves to explore of curiosity conquering fear to the point of it becoming destructive. It's all very powerfully exemplified with this story. If you are going to read At the Mountains of Madness, it is one of his longer stories. That needs to be pointed out in order to be sure that you are ready to embrace this specific story. There may be other, better introductory chapters to your experiences of reading Lovecraft. But this was my introduction to it, and it is very potent. It still is, even after several years having not read it. And I might add one last recommendation if you do. If you are overwhelmed at all by the scientific jargon that he uses and all of the heavy wording that he uses, I would actually recommend using an audiobook. There is a great YouTube channel called Horror Babble, which I listened to when I was reading this and other Lovecraftian source materials. It's narrated largely by Ian Gordon, and he adds the right kind of weight, the right kind of atmosphere, and the right kind of serious tonal delivery throughout the entire experience. It's a great channel, it's been really helpful, and I highly recommend it. Of course, the question now is, how much of that translates into a visual form? So now I'm going to be taking a break. When I get back, I'm going to be exploring a couple of specific experiences of how At the Mountains of Madness has been attempted to be made. Specifically one that I am more or less curious about, and not for lack of loving the director at the center of it. I'll be right back. And we are back. So, I hope that the first half of this episode was entertaining enough and intriguing enough to get you to this point, because now I'm about to fanboy out a bit. More than anything else, I wanted to discuss At the Mountains of Madness just so that I could geek out about Guillermo del Toro. Guillermo del Toro is one of my favorite filmmakers of all time. He's one of my biggest influences as an artist as well. I love his craftsmanship in everything that he makes. It started with Pan's Labyrinth, which is my favorite film of all time, followed almost immediately by The Devil's Backbone, after which I saw the two Hellboy films, and then Pacific Rim, and then the second Blade movie, and then Crimson Peak, and all the way to... I'm still desperate to see Kronos and Mimic. I'm pretty sure he doesn't want me to see Mimic, but at the same time, I need to see Kronos more than anything else. If anybody out there is listening and can spare about $150, could they please mail me the Criterion edition of the trilogy of Guillermo del Toro's work? That would be the best Christmas present ever. Thanks very much. And he's relevant to this discussion because more than any other filmmaker, del Toro has been influenced by Lovecraft in nearly all of his work. It's more prominent in certain specific films, and I'm talking specifically about the first Hellboy film. If you look at the imagery of the creature design in that movie, and the mythos that he has created, along with Mike Mignola, it's very much in the Lovecraftian style. Creatures like Samael, the Deathless, even the godlike creatures, the tentacles that come from the sky right at the end of the movie, those are straight out of the Lovecraftian guidebook for creature design. And it's the best. Even in his most recent film, The Shape of Water, which I have yet to see but I am desperate to see, there's a certain amount of Lovecraftian lore embedded in the basic story from what I understand about it. The connection that appears to form between Sally Hawkins's human and a fish-like creature played by Doug Jones, who is apparently not a Sabian, but definitely looks like him. That connection feels especially reminiscent of The Shadows Over Innsmouth, one of Lovecraft's other most famous works. It's not an immediate comparison, but I couldn't help but think about that, having recently done research on that particular story. But more than anything, Del Toro is relevant to this particular discussion because he is the filmmaker who has been desperately wanting to make At the Mountains of Madness into a movie for the last decade. The discussion began in 2006 when Del Toro and Matthew Robbins decided to write a screenplay treatment of Lovecraft's story. From there, he bounced it between different studios, and eventually it was going to be taken on by Universal, with James Cameron producing, following on the success of Avatar, and Tom Cruise starring in the role. I presume that means that he would be playing Dyer, although that's not entirely clear from the interviews that I have seen of it. There's no exact specification as to what Del Toro's approach to the story would have been, except for one little bit of information. He wanted it to be rated R. And Universal did not want that. Ultimately, Universal did not greenlight the picture, which was much of a dismay for Del Toro because he had been so set on making this his passion project. But there are other events that didn't really help Del Toro's case. It probably wasn't very helpful that Hellboy 2, as awesome as it is, did not really do very well at the box office compared to The Dark Knight or even Iron Man. And then, in 2012, 1 year after Universal backed out of At the Mountains of Madness, Ridley Scott released Prometheus. Now, removing any opinion that you might have about Prometheus, based on the description that I gave you, and if you have seen the film, you know how much the two of them sound very similar. The search for human evolution, the source of our creators of life, and how powerful that they can become should they rise again and decide to revolt against humanity. The reception of that film ultimately did kind of kill any hopes that Del Toro had to create At the Mountains of Madness at that time of his career. He hasn't said that he's not willing to try again. A lot of people would really be happy to see what he could do with the material, and I would be among those. In the meantime, I do still have Pacific Rim and Crimson Peak and hopefully The Shape of Water to compensate for the temporary shelving of that project. However, since we are not here to talk all about Del Toro's work, I need to discuss why I'm slightly curious as to why Del Toro wanted to make this specific Lovecraftian story into a film. Simply being a fan, I probably shouldn't have any say as to what films he decides to make. However, looking at his filmography, all of the stories that he loves to tell, and the style with which he loves to tell it, this seems like a very odd choice for him. Because, stylistically, Lovecraft is very distinct. And this is probably the most distinct out of all of his accounts. It's the most scientific in its style. It's the most detached from character or human interaction. There is still absolutely the element of fear that comes from the scale of these creatures and the ability to overwhelm humanity with their power. But there is not very much by way of character to really compensate for that kind of scientific jargon. They use phrases like Pliocene and Oligocene, Jurassic and Cretaceous, which are probably a little bit easier to remember. And they use words like Cyclopean and Blasphemous. This is very harsh, concrete language that these characters are using to describe their current situation. Now, if I can trust Del Toro with absolutely anything as a filmmaker, it is that visually, this would be a stunning, stunning movie. Partially because Del Toro has a flair for creating art direction and images and cinematography that are absolutely, utterly mesmerizing. But it also comes from the fact that because of the scientific descriptions, Lovecraft is extremely precise in the way that he describes dimensions, the shape and images of the creatures and the city, the star motifs and the pyramids. And even in some of his vaguer elements, like how he describes the Shoggoth creatures, these create a sense of dread and a sense of scale, unlike anything else that was written in pulp magazines at that time. But at the sacrifice of that, there is very little time devoted to actually exploring the characters at the center of this story. Who is Dyer? Aside from a scientist, what does he provide this character and this experience that any other scientist would provide? As the narrator, he does have probably the closest thing to an emotional connection to the audience. The other one being Danforth, and to some extent, Lake, the head of the expedition who finds the remains of the old ones, and ultimately gets killed because he is too enthusiastic and doesn't know when to stop. There's a general lack of dialogue in the entire story, aside from one line which Danforth, who is supposed to be the nervous scientist, the one who is inexperienced, he starts listing off a series of train stations in New England during a stressful situation. I mentioned that Lovecraft influenced Stephen King. I can't help but think of that scene in It where, the It miniseries, by the way, the kid holds up his bird book and just shouts random names of birds in front of a mummy creature. Yeah, that didn't really add that much, did it? The thing that I tend to note the most about Del Toro, aside from his ability to create great designs for creatures and so forth, is how much he loves his characters. He loves outcasts, and he loves weird entities, and he creates personalities for each of them by design, by dialogue, and by history. They might not always have the deepest history. Not everybody in Pacific Rim is especially deep, but I still feel like they exist in this world, and they are very much created for the purpose of this story. So if Del Toro was planning on adapting this particular story with these particular characters, it would mean that he would have to go deeper into their histories. Not necessarily in the cliché way, because I don't like having to watch all of those clichés where the soldier or the sailor or whoever has to say goodbye to their wife and they carry their picture in their pockets and they pull it out every 5 minutes just to remind you that that's the only thing that they cared about in life. I'm looking at you, Murder on the Orient Express. There needs to be more to these characters in order to give them some sense of placement, some sense of character, and some sense of the reality of this reaction that is very specific to them. There is always going to be the universal fear of experiencing something that you don't understand. I know that's a very cliche line, and I hope you keep that cliche line away from this movie as much as possible, because the only time it's ever worked is the Elephant Man. But each individual has to have a distinct personality and a distinct history in order to make it feel personal for them. Now, that's my personal wishful thinking in terms of how Del Toro could treat this particular kind of material. But let's suppose, in an imperfect world, that he doesn't get the chance to do this. What are the potential routes that this story can take if it's not going to be told in the style that Del Toro is used to making it in? I'm talking, of course, about the styles with which most studio films are now treating horror movies. Because this is a very scientific story in its style and in Lovecraft's writing, I can't help but think that there is a possibility that someone is going to take the idea of it being a scientific expedition and trying to make it look too real. Quote unquote, too real. I'm talking about found footage. I don't want it any more than you do. I am not a big fan of found footage movies. But think about this for a second. There is still a lot of potential that this kind of story could happen in this kind of way. Found footage, ever since Cloverfield came out, has been a fad that Hollywood has refused to let die, and they don't feel like they're going to stop anytime soon, unless we stop giving it money, which I really hope that we do, so that we can actually have well-shot and well-written horror movies again. I miss the days of John Carpenter's The Thing, which is another Lovecraftian-influenced story, or David Cronenberg's The Fly. All of these stories with interesting commentary attached to them. And unfortunately, nowadays, there isn't that sense of commentary in a lot of horror movies. And the found footage movement is another example of what could go wrong in this kind of storytelling. If a producer's main interest is making money, then it's entirely possible that they're only going to go the simplest route and make this a Blumhouse horror movie that's going to be sent out into a couple of small theaters just to get people's hyped up, and then make it go wide and hope that they actually buy into it before they realize there isn't a lot that they can chew on anymore. It's just a couple of cheap thrills that they can enjoy in small bursts and then completely forget about 5 minutes later. And of course, the other potential route, which has not done very well for the studio system very recently, is one that's exemplified by The Mummy. I'm not saying that The Mummy is an exact analog to what could happen to At the Mountains of Madness, but I see the potential for that happening. The first Mummy movie I have not yet seen, but I know that it is regarded as one of the classic horror films of the 1930s. Very few people would argue that it needed a remake, but now that it's had two, only one of which people actually like, it's very clear that it's not really going to be doing the studio system any favors anytime soon if they keep pursuing the Dark Universe. Apparently, the Dark Universe is not a thing anymore, but it's still something that could happen if they decide to make Lovecraft into a franchise. Lovecraft was one of the originators of a sort of shared universe between all of his different stories. There are references in At the Mountains of Madness to other stories in his mythos. The Call of Cthulhu, the Cult of Cthulhu, I should say, is actually referenced several times. The Necronomicon, or the Book of the Dead, written by the mad Arab Abdul al-Hazred. I told you he was insensitive. I'm sorry. He's constantly referenced throughout his stories. Even one of the smaller references, when the two scientists find their way over the city in their airplane, they make a reference that is very reminiscent of The Nameless City, which is apparently one of Lovecraft's favorite stories. One of the favorites that he wrote, that is. There are so many references to his work throughout all of his stories, and it's very difficult to say which ones get referenced and which ones you leave as a tease for later stories. This is something that Stephen King, again, adapted very much in his style of writing. But if there are so many connections and so many references within the world to other events that happened in other Lovecraftian stories, there is that potential that somebody could look at that and say, hey, we could make 50 different Lovecraftian movies very, very quickly, and then we can sell it as cheaply as possible. Am I coming across as a bit too cynical? I'm trying not to, because I don't think that I'm against seeing an adaptation of a Lovecraftian film. But then again, he doesn't really have a great reputation in general in terms of movie adaptations. Reanimator is apparently the only Lovecraftian adaptation that has been considered any kind of a success. And apparently that's partially because it is a smaller adaptation of one of Lovecraft's smaller stories. I have not read the story Herbert West Reanimator, nor have I seen the film. If I do, I will definitely make reference to it in a later episode. But it is still very difficult to see any other filmmaker really successfully adapting this kind of story to the screen. There are very few Lovecraftian adaptations. Dagon from 2001 was one that only paid lip service to the story that it was based on, which wasn't actually the short story Dagon, but actually The Shadows Over Innsmouth. There's a very good YouTuber named The Dom, and his series Lost in Adaptation, which focuses on the actual movies that have been made based on materials. If you're actually looking for insights into that and his opinions on that, he's actually really clever about it. And he does do an episode on Dagon, so definitely check that out. I hope you'll pardon me if I do sound a bit cynical about this possible adaptation, if it wasn't in the hands of another director who I trusted. But it is really easy these days to make very cheap, very lazy versions of horror stories. And I'm not trying to say that there are no filmmakers who could also do this adaptation. In fact, I do have a couple in mind that could potentially help this story in the style that it is actually written that honors Lovecraft. I brought this discussion up with my family recently, and I actually had an interesting realization when one of them suggested that maybe if a writer was going to try to follow the scientific route of this story, why not try to make it in the style of a BBC television adaptation? They were referring specifically to Sherlock, which immediately caught my attention, because despite how much I disliked the fourth season and felt like it was a compromise of a great character, I still really, really love that show as a whole, because I love the dynamic of the characters. I love the way that they talk, and a lot of the time, the way that they talk is very fast-paced and very scientific. But it feels natural to the character of Sherlock Holmes. And admittedly, when I did start reading this story again, while I was preparing for this particular episode, I couldn't help but think about Benedict Cumberbatch and Martin Freeman as the characters of Dyer and Danforth. Now that's going to be a little bit difficult to do, considering that both of these characters are actually Americans, and these two are British. But then again, they have been in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, both playing Americans, convincingly enough. So, there's potential. I'm not saying I want a crossover, I'm just saying that these people, these talented people, can make that kind of style work. Just so long as there's no ex machina moments like in Doctor Who or any number of other shows that Moffat loves to use, I would be into it. But again, with the scientific style. When we're talking about writers who love to embrace jargon, who love to embrace exposition, and there is a lot of exposition in this story that could definitely be explored if it's written well enough, somebody call Christopher Nolan. Once again, I'm talking about one of my favorite directors of the modern era, and I don't know how much he would be interested in this material compared to other filmmakers right now. But thinking about the style with which Nolan writes dialogue, the way that he talks about the history of his characters, literally talking about their history, without making it feel overbearing or unnatural. It flows very articulately, and it feels extremely cohesive as a whole. You're never bored while watching a Nolan movie. At least I'm never bored watching a Nolan movie. Even a movie like Interstellar, which is probably his most science fiction-y style of story, he doesn't feel like he is trying to force science on you. It's an exploration of science, and he does have scientific reasoning behind some of his theoretical depictions of different planets. It's still a character piece, and the characters are fairly simple, but they're well acted by Matthew McConaughey and Anne Hathaway, and they have a lot to say about their feelings, which doesn't feel like they're imposing their feelings on you. Some of you may disagree, but I think that it's close enough to a reason to say that if we were going to take the style of a exposition-heavy, dialogue-heavy adaptation of this particular story, Nolan could pull it off. And even more than that, if we weren't going to go for the dialogue-heavy style, I would be very open to a science fiction Dunkirk. Nolan is probably the closest that I can think of who can pull off both of those things, especially with Dunkirk coming out earlier this year and surprising a lot of people with its sparseness and the style with which he shows the attack on these soldiers rather than telling them. It's a very powerful experience watching that. And again, it would be stunningly shot with Heuter von Heutera, I believe that's how I pronounce his name, and it would just be an amazing experience to see in IMAX. If there is any potential that this could happen, I would be very happy to see Nolan writing the screenplay while Del Toro was a director. But if it could only be one or the other, I would be perfectly happy to see either of their visions of this story take form on screen. This is totally me fanboying about the two of them, but I am thinking just as much about Lovecraft's style. And Lovecraft's style lends itself to both of these kinds of filmmakers, the ones that are very scientific, very articulate, and very precise in their execution, and then there are ones that just simply want to draw you into the experience, the ones that are interested in the world, but also in the way that the characters feel and experience that world, just on a visual, quiet, and profound level. These are styles that I would love to see either way, and it would be interesting to see what both of them could do if they collaborated, but if that's not going to happen, I would be happy with one or the other. So I'm going to take one more break, and then we're going to be coming back a little bit just to discuss a little bit further why Lovecraft is not always the greatest source of an adaptation. I'll be right back. And we are back. Here we go. So what we have lined up for the last part of this episode is just a bit of a discussion on the various adaptations that have occurred based on Lovecraft's work. And I'm not talking about movie adaptations, although there are, again, just a few that some work and some don't. But there are other examples of media that has been based on works of H.P. Lovecraft. And I'm talking, interestingly enough, about games, both video games and board games. More than anywhere else, I keep seeing references to the Cthulhu mythos and to Lovecraft's work in general in these two sources. Specifically in the video gaming world, there is an upcoming adaptation of The Call of Cthulhu, which is coming out. Apparently, this is a remake or a reboot of a former video game from the early 1980s, I want to say. And this is actually something that I'm open to, I'm curious about, but at the same time, when I see the trailer for this adaptation, I don't really see the Call of Cthulhu, the story itself. I see references that I myself might not be articulate enough to get at this moment, either to the original game or to the original story and other stories that are intermingled with this one. Because I've only read Call of Cthulhu once, fairly recently, but I don't have all the knowledge of all of the references that this trailer might be making. But the other source that I keep seeing a lot of times are board games. Games like Eldritch Horror and Unspeakable Words and Reign of Cthulhu, which is an expansion on Paramedic, I believe. That's weird. Mythos, Elder Signs, Arkham Horror, which I'm actually surprised it took me this long to mention that Arkham Asylum from the Batman stories is literally named after a city and a college from this specific universe. And yes, there is a board game adaptation of this particular story entitled Mountains of Madness. I have not played it yet, but I do plan to, and if I ever get to it, I will be sure to bring it up ever so briefly in another episode. So there's a lot of references to the Cthulhu mythos and to Lovecraft's work in a lot of different materials. But at the same time, when it comes to actual adaptations, you don't really see a lot of the depth that we hope to get when you read Call of Cthulhu or any number of other sources, including the Mountains of Madness. A lot of that does have to do with the way that Lovecraft does present his world in a generally vague way. He can give specific descriptions, but when he is intentionally vague, he is intentionally vague. You cannot tell half of the things that he is explaining because they are so bizarre and they are so articulate while also being very nondescript. In the case of At the Mountains of Madness, the Shoggoth's creatures are a perfect example of this. They're given vague descriptions, a black mass with strange, bubbly skin and eerie, ever-changing eyes. But that kind of form is always shifting. It's changing. It's never staying in one position at one time, so there's no real distinction of what this specific creature looks like on a constant basis. And to some extent, I think that might be why some of the horror movies that are based on Lovecraft's work don't really work as well, because when you're looking at the creatures in At the Mountains of Madness, they are so vague, but they are so grand and immense and frightening that they sink into the character's soul, and they change them, and they warp their brains to the point where they can no longer think the way that they used to. There's no real monster that really has that kind of essence nowadays in modern horror, and once you give a monster a physical form, if it's a literary monster, it automatically drains it of some of the imagination that the reader puts into seeing that monster as they see it. Yes, there are some distinctly bizarre creatures, even in this story, where there are weird ideas of how certain animals from the Antarctic would look. I'll tell you. Blind albino penguins. It sounded way cooler when he was writing it. But in essence, that kind of creepy sensation of not knowing the exact image of what this monster would look like in this situation is kind of drained when it's trying to be shown on a visual level. So there is always that question of how exactly do you explain the unexplainable? That's one of the questions that has to be raised when you are adapting any number of horror stories, but it's applicable to Lovecraft especially. Lovecraft was a master of atmosphere and a master of drawing an audience into a world that they did not understand and were scared of because they couldn't understand it. The questions raised by the people in that world are all based on the existential question of what happens when people and creatures that are beyond your comprehension arrive and start to control you, or potentially threaten to take control of you. There's an element of horror to it, and there's also an element of mystery to it. The creatures of Cthulhu, and the old ones in this case, they are always present in your mind after you have witnessed them. And the threat that they impose upon you, whether they state that threat or not, will always remain inside of you from that day forward. It would be interesting to see whether or not any of these stories could actually express that in a visual media, now that we have so many different monster movies and so many different horror movies that try to give people the sensation, if just for a brief moment. In the case of Lovecraft, he made it into his entire purpose as a writer. With all of his short stories, whenever he published them, there was always that sense throughout the entire story of the existential dread and the fear of being overpowered. The question becomes how much of that can be translated to the modern era and to modern audiences. Maybe this could have worked great in the 1930s when people didn't really have as many monsters or didn't have as wide a view of the world as they do now. But there is still a potential for a lot of real creativity, whether in terms of design, in terms of world building, in terms of an interpretation of what Lovecraft's existential dread can mean in any given situation. There's a lot of filmmakers that have been influenced by Lovecraft throughout their lives. There have been many writers that have been influenced by Lovecraft. But there is still not the definitive adaptation of a Lovecraft story. Are we going to get it at any point? I don't know. There is still potential that Del Toro could make this story if any number of his other films are a success, and if studios respect him as much as his fans do. Once again, however, we're still in the dark. We won't know for absolute until the day comes when the Shoggoth's cry echoes through the dark halls of an ancient dead city. Hello again. Welcome to The Appendices, the segment where I look back on my old content and either expand on the subjects I couldn't discuss before, or just generally rip the episode you just heard to shreds. Much like last time, however, that's not so much the case here. This exercise is not paying off so much in these early episodes because overall, I like these first four episodes. For a show where I clearly wasn't working from a script, I can still somehow ascertain what I'm talking about. You know, 80% of the time. Yeah, I did not miss just winging it on the day. Then again, I also don't like writing my scripts. I guess the other alternative to either of those things is just a long period of radio silence. Oh lordy, what if that's actually what people want? No! I must appease the content gods. Therefore, by the time of episode 10, I finally bit the bullet and wrote a script to any episode hosted solely by myself. That way, I could manage my highly articulate nonsense and not spend 12 hours huddled in the college basement. Even though I would usually do that regardless. Anyhow, my opinions on Lovecraft have surprisingly maintained a general state of broad interest since recording this show. It seems weird that so many storytellers whom I aspire to are so very enamored with Lovecraft, and yet, much like Poe, I've read very little of Lovecraft's work myself. I've even played some of the games I mentioned at the end of this episode more readily than I've read his stories.
The Call of Cthulhu video game did not get a strong enough reception to justify my playing it, but the board game Arkham Horror is an absolute blast, and a really cool team-building exercise for nerds of all backgrounds. What I've really come to admire about Lovecraft is his sense of scale, and how forces beyond our understanding seem so vast and overwhelming compared to our quaint existence. The feeling of human insignificance in the face of an unpredictable and uncaring pantheon is truly one of the most daunting and unsettling notions a horror author could explore. But for me, I think my biggest beef with Lovecraft as a reader is ironically the thing that I praised him for so much in this episode, his academic tone. To some extent, I feel the emotionality in Lovecraft's worlds, potential emotionality, is lost somewhat in his tendency to emphasize accounts of events rather than showing the actual events themselves. It gives the story a sense of legitimacy to think that someone was actually adamant on chronicling these horrifying events. But the scientific jargon isn't for everyone, and it definitely gives off the sense that his intended audience was the rich, affluent, thinking men, more than the masses. At the same time, I appreciated the detail about the equipment and scientific processes used during the Miskatonic expedition. I used to want to study paleontology in high school, so it gives me a bit of a buzz every time I mention the word Jurassic or carbon dating. I think it's very clear that Lovecraft is very methodical and expository in his approach to revealing information, which might not be for everyone, but it works in the context of his stories. This is mostly my personal reason for not being as into Lovecraft as everyone else. Although for most others, I'm pretty sure they'll probably find more to criticize in Lovecraft's tendency towards a xenophobic point of view. I'm not so much the guy to talk about that. I'm a white guy who has limited experience with dealing with racism in reality, so when I discuss race relations, it's usually in a text where it's the primary focus of the story. This particular text, At the Mountains of Madness, does not implement those undertones as heavily, so I didn't feel the need to explore that as much here. The most that I really went into was mentioning the Mad Arab and his role in creating the incredibly dangerous Necronomicon. The whole emphasis on xenophobia approach to analyzing Lovecraft is pretty much exemplified by a very funny YouTube channel, Overly Sarcastic Productions. Their Halloween special on Lovecraft is extremely witty and goes well with their cartoonish animation style, while also capturing Lovecraft's ability to create baffling scale and drawn-out scenes of growing dread. They've also produced a summary of Dante's Divine Comedy, which is easily the best breakdown of one of the most boring texts I can claim to be influenced by. Hey, just because I lift basic concepts from some old poem or other doesn't mean I inherently like them. Also, the video I mentioned in the episode, Dagon Lost in Adaptation, is still on YouTube. It's produced by Dominic Noble, formerly The Dom, and it's also a very good introduction to Lovecraft as far as his themes, atmosphere, and intrigue are concerned, as well as the lack thereof in the finished film. I think anybody is able to do their own research and decide whether or not they can look at Lovecraft's work separate from his personality, or else you'll just read them without much thought and see if his style works for you to begin with. It's fair to say that Lovecraft's imitators, including Gaiman and Del Toro, though less so Stephen King, are a bit more culturally sensitive. This is a little ironic, because I'd argue that with his American settings, interconnecting universe, and overall dread-filled stories about mind-controlling aliens and ghostly monsters, King is probably the closest in emulating the style of Lovecraft's horror between those three. Gaiman's works are more grand epic fantasy, which embrace a sort of pantheonism. While Del Toro, even though his films straddle horror and fantasy at the same time, very much focuses on speaking up for the downtrodden, the oppressed, and the societal rejects. In short, one of the reasons I'm curious as to why Del Toro wanted to make this movie is, well, he just likes his monsters too much. This brings me to the point where I look back on my comment connecting The Shadow Over Innsmouth and The Shape of Water. Spoilers for both, I guess, but if you've heard anything about The Shape of Water on the internet, it's for this one reason. Anyway, for those of you unfamiliar, Shadow Over Innsmouth is a story about an isolated town in Massachusetts where everyone is slowly turning into a fish person. This is largely to do with cult worship of Dagon, not the Mesopotamian one, the fishy old one. And it also has to do with interspecies breeding between humans and fish folk. I think I may have been the only person who knew that Del Toro was going to be exploring a similar type of relationship before his latest film was released, so I wasn't surprised when some people gawked at it. Once again, Del Toro's approach is much more romantic and sincere than Lovecraft's Tale of Terror, and it's probably fair to say that his influences in this case were clearly much less Lovecraft and much more Beauty and the Beast starring the creature from the Black Lagoon. And it works wonderfully on that level, both because he has a wonderful script and because Doug Jones and Sally Hawkins are wonderful actors in and out of makeup respectively. Plus he won 2 Oscars for it, which basically nullifies any jokes that could be made against that movie. Except the ones that I make when I notice a glaring similarity to Pan's Labyrinth, which should have won everything when it came out, but the Academy was too busy catching up to Martin Scorsese at the time. Always the cyclical thing with those guys, you know? This leaves us with the final question. Is Del Toro still interested in making this film? I can only assume that he is. It's just that he doesn't have time to, and he doesn't have a home for it yet. Part of me hoped after Del Toro won the Oscar that he would be given absolute free rein to do whatever he wants with his career. Not that he hadn't done that already, but I really wanted to see what he could do if a studio truly gave him the budget he wanted to make this movie the way he wanted it. However, besides producing like 15 different DreamWorks animation productions all at once, he's now moved on to a different passion project, a stop-motion adaptation of Pinocchio, produced and distributed by Netflix. It's set for release in 2021, which is the longest gap between Del Toro Pictures I can remember. And with that on his plate, he'll want to make the best version of that film that he can. He was hoping that one day he'll get up to par with his amigos Alfonso Cuarón and Alejandro Iñárritu, and win himself a second Oscar. The script for At the Mountains of Madness still exists. It may not be the same as it used to be, but there is potential that it could one day blow the walls off the silver screen. It wouldn't be the first Lovecraft adaptation, but it could be the film that redeems the author's unfilmable reputation. As far as I know, the only quote-unquote critically acclaimed adaptation of Lovecraft's work exists in the form of a silent movie homage produced by the H.P. Lovecraft Historical Society, which adapts the story of The Call of Cthulhu. Actually, that sounds kind of awesome. I don't know how they'd present the scale of the Elder Gods, but if it's anything akin to the old-fashioned visual effects a la Fritz Lang or Georges Méliès, I would die of the epictude. I love the 1920s so much. Anyway, that's the end of the episode. If you want to engage with this discussion in any way, if you have a suggestion for what subjects you'd like to hear more about, or what stories I should look into as potential episodes, please let me know. As of yesterday, I no longer have a personal Twitter account, but you can still follow me on Instagram at DASkyThor. And you can also send me an email at adaptationalpod@gmail.com. That's adaptation, A-L, pod as in podcast, @gmail.com. Our theme music comes to us courtesy of the East Village Opera Company, so thank you very much to those guys. Next episode, we'll see the return of the only major work of graphic literature I covered in the first season, and perhaps the most profound wartime survival story that just happens to star anthropomorphic animals. It's Art Spiegelman's Mouse. I hope you're ready to cry. In the meantime, keep those pages turning, and I'll see you next time on Adaptational.